This is The Book and the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
Archaeologists are problem solvers, and that's what archaeology is all about, according to James Strange in his new book, Excavating the Land of Jesus. Professor Strange teaches New Testament at Samford University and directs the excavations at Shekin, a small village in the Galilee near Nazareth. In the first part of our conversation, Professor Strange noted that his father first identified the site of Shekin and surveyed it about 35 years ago, when he was working nearby at Sepphoris. Research by another scholar indicated that Shekin was apparently a pottery production center. Then, after the Sepphoris excavation ended, which he had co-directed with his father in the final years, Professor Strange decided to excavate Shekin.
We surveyed it again in 2011 and started digging in 2012 and right away found the synagogue. Then that was significant because it's very difficult to find a previously unknown synagogue in the Galilee, because most of them have been identified by surveys and excavations starting in the late 19th century. So even the synagogues that my father had excavated up in northern Galilee, all of those have been previously identified.
So in terms of thinking of archaeology as problem solving, what was the problem you were trying to solve when you began the excavations at Shekin?
One of the first problems was to confirm what we had seen in the survey. So when you survey a site for excavation, often you're simply walking the ground, spreading out in a line and walking along, looking for anything that is sort of interrupting the organic jumble of nature. You know, three stones make a wall, we say, or looking for a collection of pottery sherds, which Shekin is simply covered with pottery. So during that survey, we collected a lot of pottery. We had analyzed it, and in the 1988 survey, they had done the same. And so by doing that, you established some parameters for when the village is occupied. But you're still not getting enough to be able to say, okay, now we know. So in order to get at least a better bite on that, you've got to do some digging. So we said one of our problems is, can we confirm the time period during which the hill was occupied from sometime in the second century BC, which we call late Hellenistic, on into the mid 4th century AD, which is when the Roman period ends and the Byzantine period begins. It looked like, from what we could see, that there was no Byzantine occupation, that the village had ceased to exist really before the Byzantine period began. And that's what we have confirmed in our excavation. Another problem was, well, how big was the settlement? And now, of course, in order to do that, you have a couple of ways that you can begin to narrow it down, since you never excavate an entire site, even a small village. One thing is to find the tombs. So if you have a village that you think is occupied by Jews or mostly Jews, you know that when you found the tombs, you found the farthest point at which the village can exist, because they build tombs outside of the village, typically to the east or to the northeast. And sure enough, we had tombs to the east. We actually had some to the south as well. From that, we began to say, okay, it has to be smaller than that. So there's going to be some space between the village, its industry, and the tombs. And then, of course, once you start digging, you start generating more questions. Even if you think you satisfied your first questions, you're going to end up asking a whole bunch more. One of the things that David Adonbiewicz had said was that Shekin is distributing storage jars, or mostly storage jars. In fact, this jar is now called the Shekin storage jar. When we started finding pottery manufacturing waste, we were finding a whole lot more than storage jars. We were finding cooking pots and jugs and really all of the common Galilean forms, and some uncommon ones too. So we began to say, well, maybe they're distributing more than storage jars. That's one of our ongoing questions. We need to do the same kind of elemental analysis that David Adonbiewicz did, which was neutron activation analysis of our pottery and of pottery found at other sites, and say, can we confirm what he said? Or can we say, no, this site had cooking pots from Shekin and jugs from Shekin and bowls. So they're distributing more than storage jars. Another thing that we found early on was we started finding molds for making oil lamps. Well, one of the hypotheses that had been floating around was that, unlike vessels, pots and jugs and jars and those kinds of things, lamps were made in cities, because a couple of molds had been found in Sepphoris and some molds had been known to come from Caesarea, places like that. But we started finding them at Shechin. And then we started finding a whole bunch of them. I don't know how many we have, how many fragments of lamp molds we have now, but it's got to be way past 50, which is more than you expect to find in a village excavation. This is a type of lamp that dates to after the lifetime of Jesus. So you typically date it somewhere between 70, which is around the year that Jerusalem and the temple are destroyed, and then 135, which is the end of the next revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt. Couple of lamp types that are found there. So one of our questions or one of our problems then became, well, okay, is Shechin making these for distribution or are they making them in-house only? Well, we're finding far too much production, we think, for it to be simply use in the village itself. And sure enough, through some preliminary petrographic analysis where a geologist through a microscope looks at the broken edge of the pottery and can identify the type of clay it's made from, our geologist is Anastasia Shapiro. She says, okay, I can tell you that, first of all, your lamps are being made from local clay for the most part. And I can tell you that I looked at lamps from of this period from five other villages of the Galilee. And in every single one, I found lamps that I think are made from Shechin clay. Now, we need to do some more. Again, we need to do neutron activation analysis to confirm that. But that's another problem that we're currently working on.
For those who have just joined us, we're talking with Professor James Strange, who teaches New Testament at Samford University and is the author of a new book, Excavating the Land of Jesus. He also directs the Shechin Excavation Project near Nazareth, which we've been talking about. So you talk about lamps being made in mold, so that's different from a lot of pottery that's made on a wheel.
That's right. As a matter of fact, probably the most common type of oil lamp just before this kind of lamp is made is thrown on a wheel. And for a long time, it was called the Herodian lamp because it was made chiefly during the reigns of the Herods. It's these days called a knife-paired oil lamp. They're talking about paring away the edge of the nozzle. So the vessel itself that holds the oil is thrown on the wheel, a bowl with a steeply incurved rim, with a hole in the middle for filling it with oil. But then they stick a nozzle on the outside of that and have to poke a hole through the nozzle into the body of the lamp so that the wick can get to the oil. But as they smooth that nozzle onto the body of the lamp, then they use some kind of knife to pare away the edge of that nozzle to make the distinctive shape, but they leave the marks of the paring. Well, I'm now advocating for going back to Herodian or choosing some other name, because when they start making the kind of lamp that we're finding, they're now molding the entire thing in a mold. It still has a circular body because they're using a compass to inscribe a circle on the mold and carve that out. So they have a circular body, but the nozzle is now part of the molded lamp. Yeah. And they're still sometimes paring them. So even though they don't need to do that, or they're not having to smooth a nozzle connecting to the body where it connects to the body of the lamp, I think they still have this pairing. But you can tell one that comes from a molded lamp because you can see the seam on the inside of the nozzle where the two halves have been pressed together, whereas that's invisible. It's not there on a Herodian lamp.
Do archaeologists have any idea why the change?
They don't have a technological reason. What we have is conjecture, first of all, about how trauma has an effect on material culture. We don't know why it does, but it does. So often we're tying shifts in manufacturing, both how they make things and how they look. You know, often we tie those to major shifts, and a lot of these major shifts have to do with war. We do see shifts in the way people are making things or things that they are making and they no longer make, that happened around the year 70 with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. That's a question about human motivation and values and trauma. It is speculation. David Adonbaye was the guy that I talked about before, and his team, they did another analysis of Herodian lamps. And they said, okay, here's the deal. Everybody's making these lamps and everybody's using them, including non-Jews. So if you excavate a city with a big Gentile population, you'll still find these lamps. Furthermore, we can show you that they can make them from local clays. So that everybody knows how to make the lamps and they have the clays to make them. But when we started analyzing them using neutron activation analysis and analyzing lamps from Jerusalem, made from Jerusalem clays, we can show you that in any northern city far removed from Jerusalem, if there is a Jewish population there, like at Sepphoris, more than 80% of the lamps will have been made from clays from Jerusalem. And if it's a village with an entirely Jewish or nearly entirely Jewish population, more than 90% have been made in Jerusalem. So even though they know how to make them, they want to get them from Jerusalem. There's lots of reasons that that could happen. There's some speculation about pilgrimage to the festivals, especially the temple itself, which has a stand that holds seven oil lamps burning. And that for many Jews in particular, this lamp represents something about this pilgrimage. Light is extremely thick as a metaphor for thinking about such things as justice and righteousness and wisdom and God's presence. So, of course, that becomes speculative. We don't have any texts talking about that, but we do have this phenomenon. Well, now the temple's gone. So what are people doing? Maybe this is a sign of some loss of hope. Maybe it's a sign that we're doing things differently now. What they start doing also on these lamps is they start decorating them. That Herodian lamp is no decorations other than a few lines and a few circles and dots. But this kind of lamp is highly decorated, but it's decorated with things like grapevines and leaves and pomegranates and sometimes geometric patterns. The ones that are made near Jerusalem sometimes have other things like birds on them. We have found no animal representations, not even fish or anything like that. Sometimes farming implements, sometimes earrings, sometimes door keys are depicted on these. We have not found any of those. The only human-made object that we have found has been what they call amphora. So we have found a few of those on some of our lamps and one menorah. One little teeny-weeny fragment with a very small menorah on it.
Well, yeah. There's a lot more that I'd like to ask you about the excavations at Shekin and also about your book, Excavating the Land of Jesus, but we're running out of time here. So in closing, I'd just like to mention how much I enjoyed one of the quotes at the end of your book, which said, "Those who embark on archaeology are generally fascinated and seldom bored."
That is true. Although archaeology can be tedious.
Yeah, it's a lot of digging in the dirt, you know, which was my realization on the night before I started working as a volunteer at Telefect many decades ago. I said, wait a minute, I signed up for a lot of physical labor here. So
I paid a lot of money to work really hard.
Well, volunteering and volunteers are important for biblical archaeology, as we've said many times. If you'd like to think about being a volunteer, this book, Excavating the Land of Jesus by James Riley Strange, published by Erdmans, is a great introduction to the work that goes on and how archaeologists think. Our thanks to Professor Strange for joining us on today's program. We'd like to remind our listeners we have more information on biblical archaeology on our website at radioscribe.com, including information on Artifacts, our biblical archaeology news magazine, and our upcoming trip to Israel in November of 2024. We also have news videos from the Israel Antiquities Authority at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.